Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Cheese and butter, again, observed strong domestic demand, pulling those prices higher. While on the other hand, lower international prices, strong international competition, pulling down prices for non-fat dry milk and dry whey products.
Recent numbers from the WASDE report. Mark Jackanowski, World Ag Outlook Board Chair.
Class prices, class three price up, up 5 cents per hundredweight, mainly reflecting higher cheese prices, offsetting the lower whey price. Class four price down, mainly driven lower by the lower non-fat dry price. And all milk price up 30 cents per hundredweight this month to $21.25 per hundredweight.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Global wheat production.
Dr. Mark Jackanowski, chairman of the World Ag Outlook Board, with the latest World Ag Supply Demand Estimates.
Basically, what we have here is essentially a lot of updated government estimates, updated data that net out to an increase in global wheat production of 1 million tons. So all of these, including Russia, that's Rostat data, so we're more in line with their production estimates this year. And, so as you can see, nothing huge this month in terms of the global wheat production situation. Balance sheet, few things worth noting here. Feed use up 1.6 million tons. Couple things there, mainly two countries, EU, where we're seeing increased imports from Ukraine, increased wheat supplies going into EU from Ukraine, and then Kazakhstan, where they had some rain at harvest, so that's impacting the quality. So more feed use for wheat in Kazakhstan. Ending stocks tightening up, lowest since 2015-16. Trade up the 1.4 million tons. That is mainly Ukraine. We raised again 1 million tons, now at 16 million. Australia also up on larger crop. Larger crop estimate there, partially offset by lower exports out of the U.S., which I'll talk about soon. Ending stocks tightening up a bit. That is mainly lower stocks in China and Ukraine, given that they're exporting more.
In the March World Ag Supply Demand Estimates, or WASDE report, USDA also revising cotton.
So here we'll talk about the U.S. in a couple slides from now. Other countries, Argentina, production down 100,000 bales, just not ideal conditions, a little bit. That's a yield reduction. It's been a little bit dry there, impacting the yield outlook. And in India, up 500,000 bales, and that is just based on arrivals data. So global balance sheet. Few things I'll note here. Consumption, we raised 500,000 bales. That's mainly China and India. Trade is up 400,000 bales. That is mainly imports into China, where essentially declines, lower imports everywhere in, among all of the other major importing countries. So China, demand from China remains strong. That's driving that consumption increase this month. And some of those imports clearly are going into state reserves, into China's own stocks. U.S. cotton balance sheet. Here, we made some adjustments based on the cotton ginnings report that we got this morning from NASS. And essentially, it suggests that the crop is a bit smaller, 330,000 bales smaller than we had been forecasting. And in this case, that virtually all comes out of ending stocks, tightening up ending stocks. Didn't make any change to our export forecast. Also didn't make any change to our price forecast. About two-thirds of the crop is marketed at this point. As you know, prices have spiked in the past couple of weeks, but certainly short-term doesn't give us enough of enough to base any kind of change in the farmer price at this point.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
In the renewable fuel standards, renewable diesel, and I'm going to put FAME biodiesel in with it at this point because they, in essence, compete for the same buckets in the RFS. Those two biofuels can both go to what is known as the biodiesel mandate.
Dr. Scott Irwin is a University of Illinois ag economist.
They can also fill something called the undifferentiated advanced mandate above the biodiesel mandate. I know that's a real mouthful, but it's just another bucket. That's all you need to know. And then there's a third bucket that renewable diesel and FAME can fill, are eligible to fill, called the conventional gap. And that's the difference between the E10 blend wall and what is known as the conventional mandate. The EPA announced in 2023 final what are called renewable volume obligations, or RVOs, for 2023 through 2025, which just allows you to do some simple arithmetic and you can estimate the maximum demand for renewable diesel and FAME biodiesel to be roughly in a range of 4 to 4.5 billion gallons per year. 4 to 4.5 billion gallons per year. Remember, that's what the RIN market and the RVOs are telling us. That's the maximum amount that is needed to fulfill the market demand set by the RFS. So we're going to take that as a given. Now let's go back to some data on production capacity. This chart is more short-term than what I showed you earlier and a little different. It's monthly, and it shows something called operable capacity by month for both FAME biodiesel and renewable diesel as tracked by the EIA, the Energy Information Agency. And we noticed something, you know, obviously, as we're adding renewable diesel capacity in new plants, the green bar has been expanding and the orange bar for FAME has been basically stagnant. So that's the total capacity that we have. And notice that really we're almost all of 2023 and now heading into 2024, that's been well north of 5 billion gallons of combined operable capacity. Now let's put that in perspective of that demand ceiling based on the 23 through 25 RFS RVOs. And we have shot well past market demand for combined renewable diesel and FAME biodiesel for a number of months now. And this is where we want to revisit that number that I asked you to remember from the annual renewable diesel production capacity chart that was so dramatic that I showed you at the beginning of my presentation, and that was 1.5 billion gallons. That is the amount of new renewable diesel capacity that is scheduled to come online in 2024, and it all signs point to that being roughly what's going to happen. Now think about this chart. That means that total physical production capacity for FAME and renewable diesel in 2024 is going to go well north of 7 billion gallons. 7 billion gallons when the market demand is someplace in the range of 4 to 4.5 billion gallons. Now, Houston, we really have a problem. We're basically into a situation of dramatic oversupply of renewable diesel.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're looking for that first hollow stem on wheat. We've got a low inventory of cows. There's very little evidence in the information we're seeing that producers have started to hold back heifers as replacements. And we've got really good, historically high calf prices.
Oklahoma State beef breeding specialist, Mark Johnson.
So it's on a lot of people's mind. How many heifers should we keep back out of those yearlings that we may have out on cool season grass right now? So what should we consider? First thing I would take a look at, among a list of things we're going to go through, is just the puberty status of those heifers. It's important that those heifers are cycling, they've reached puberty, and they're ready to breed up quick whenever we turn out bulls or start our breeding season. There's research and evidence out there that tells us that the heifers that breed within the first 21 days of breeding season and correspondingly calve in the first 21 days of their calving season end up weaning more pounds of calf over their lifetime in production, have more longevity in production, and are just flat out the more profitable cows for us. So one of the things that producers can do to help in this regard is do a reproductive track score on those heifers 4 to 6 weeks prior to turnout or breeding season starting, and it's going to indicate the reproductive readiness of those heifers. The second important thing to consider is the fertility of the heifers. Now, this isn't really something we can eyeball them and look at, but as we turn out bulls and start breeding season, it's reasonable to think that heifers that are 14 to 15 months of age and 65% of their mature weight at the beginning of breeding season, we should see 60 to 70% of those heifers conceive on first service, and by the end of a 60 to 65-day breeding season, 90 to 95% of those heifers bred. If we go in with an early preg check, say 30 days with ultrasound after we have pulled bulls, those heifers that are open can still be marketed as yearlings as a premium at that point. And if we hold those heifers accountable and get rid of those subfertile heifers, it's going to end up leading to more fertility in our cow herds for us long term. Another thing to take into consideration is the potential milk that those heifers are going to give. We want cows that mature out at a size and have a level of milk that fits our production environment, the feed and forage resources that we got for them. How do we go about selecting for this? Even though milk is low in heritability, taking into account the milk EPDs on the bulls that sired those heifers is an effective means of selection. And kind of folding into that topic, we want to take a look at the growth rate of those heifers. Typically, it's heifers that have a good growth rate relative to a moderate frame size that are going to mature out and make the most practical kind of cows for us that are the best fit to our operation. And when it comes to that thing that we can see and maybe take a look at some of the ancestors on, taking a look at that udder and teat or mammary system on a heifer is good. We don't want to see their teats really small or embedded in fat. When possible, it's good to select heifers that we know are out of good uddered cows. We would like to identify heifers that are going to have good maternal calving ease. We can take pelvic area measurements on those yearling heifers. They're going to be measured in square centimeters, and typically whatever that pelvic area is, if we divide 2.1 into that, it gives us an indication of how many pounds of how big a calf fetus could be for them to deliver that unassisted as a two-year-old. When it comes to calving ease, we can also take a look at the calving ease maternal EPD of the sire of those heifers, if that's available to us. In that particular CEM EPD, as it's reported in most beef breeds, a higher number indicates a greater likelihood that that bull's daughters are going to give birth to their first calf unassisted.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Corn production, to point out change we made for Argentina.
Mark Jackanowski, chair of the World Ag Outlook Board, with the latest numbers from the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report.
Based on use data, we raised the size of that crop by 1 million tons, so a larger Argentina crop. That also carries through into the new crop year, kind of calibrating from that. It's an area adjustment. So calibrating from that higher area, that's going to carry through into the new crop year, along with also supported by data from the Bolsa. Mexico corn production, we reduced 1 million tons. Drought conditions, we'll talk about that more when we talk about sugar. But drought conditions in Mexico, low reservoir levels, and this is winter corn planting, which we're planting is just underway now. So that's where that production cut is coming from. The rest of it, Ukraine, Russia, largely harvest results there. Some modest reductions in production for those areas. And in South Africa, we'll talk about that just a bit. We cut South Africa production as well. South Africa corn production, just a map of the main regions within South Africa where corn is produced, and to point out that we're kind of in mid-season here. Crop has been planted. We've got, you know, a little bit more than a month or so before harvest really picks up with any intensity. So mid-season, but basically we're looking at what has been really since January, pretty dry and hot conditions. So we're going to look at two main regions here. Central Corn Belt, things really dried out starting early to mid-January and remained dry. Similar Western Corn Belt, again, dry conditions, good rain earlier in the season, and then it's been dry again since early to mid-January. And it's also been hot, so temperatures well above average. And for the most part, above last year as well. in both of the in both of these main production areas. So given that, you know, we anticipate production to be down this year, year over year, and we trimmed yield, which is driving that lower production forecast this month. Global corn balance sheet, a few things to point out here as well. Put up the back year balance sheet again. So corn trade reduced 800,000 tons this month, mainly reflecting a couple things. Higher late season shipments from Argentina, more than offset by lower shipments from Brazil. So I mentioned earlier that we raised Argentina's production, partly because we saw that those higher export shipments. But on the other hand, Brazil shipments have been turned out lower than we anticipated. Still record, nevertheless, for last year from Brazil. So then for the new crop year, carrying in a little bit higher beginning stocks, that's mainly in Brazil, given their lower exports from the previous year. Production we talked about, tightening up total supply by about 1 million tons. Trade up 1.4 million tons, mainly reflecting two things. Argentina, higher exports out of Argentina. We raised a million tons. And also Ukraine, up 1.5 million tons this month, now at 25.5 million tons. And that's offset partially by lower exports out of South Africa and India. And South Africa reflecting smaller crop. India reflecting just the fact that they are not price competitive in global markets. U.S. balance sheet, not much to talk about here other than that we lowered the price a bit. Again, just reflecting reported prices to date. And again, that probably is not a big surprise given where markets have been going for the past several months. Prices have been going for the past several months.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Is there a place or pathway for soybeans in the SAF market in connection to these soybean oil plants?
At a recent renewable diesel webinar, University of Illinois Extension's Scott Irwin.
Yes, absolutely. Technologically speaking, at the present time, the only proven technology for making SAF in truly industrial scale quantities is through what I call the RD production technology pathway. We know how to do it. There's plants that already have made that investment to produce SAF. So technology is signed, sealed, and delivered. It exists, and it can be done, and it will be done to some degree to answer that question. The question is, you know, there's a big race right now or competition between which technology is in the longer term going to fulfill the SAF bucket. The only one that's proven at industrial scale right now is through renewable diesel, soybean oil, and UCO and those kind of feedstocks. That can be done, is being done. The second one is ethanol to jet fuel, which I think is going to be a formidable competitor in the long run if some things happen. But at this point, nobody has actually demonstrated that ethanol to jet fuel can actually be produced at industrial scale. Everybody's saying it will happen, it will happen, it will happen. And I think that they're probably right. But we heard the same messages from about cellulosic ethanol about 15 years ago. So that's the answer to that question.
And another question.
Are there any guardrails on RD imports? How can we be sure imported RD uses the feedstock that it claims? I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at the question. I'm laughing because this is a white hot issue. Can we even tell the difference between imported conventional and renewable diesels? I think the answer, I'll work backwards, is no. I don't think there's little to, if any way, to audit either the feedstocks that are now being imported into the U.S. or the biofuel or the things like renewable diesel and FAME that are flooding into the U.S. right now. I'm going to illustrate my point this way. This really all revolves around palm oil, which is the 800-pound gorilla of global veg oil markets. And so therefore, palm oil is generally the cheapest veg oil in the world, but because of deforestation issues, it's generally not eligible to fulfill things like the renewable fuel standard or the low carbon fuel standard in California. Years ago, I heard about the joke about coming out of Asia is that, oh, You want UCO or used cooking oil? Get a great big tank of palm oil, drop a bag of potato chips in it, and voila, you have used cooking oil. Here's the way I look at this, not the morals of the situation, morality of it. It's the way I look at it as an economist, pure economically. The economic incentives for cheating that way are so large, it has to be happening. And I know that my policy friends and others would, might be shocked that I would make that statement, but I will say that it has to be happening both in terms of the FAME and RD being imported in the U.S. And we'll notice we're getting a huge surge of UCO imported into the U.S. Guarantee you, my opinion, I have no hard evidence on this, that some significant part of that is some sketchy version of palm oil.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Beef production up a bit this month.
Chairman of the World Ag Outlook Board, Dr. Mark Jekinowski, with the latest from the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report.
That's mainly based on, although we had lower production the first quarter of this year, but we expect the pace to increase in the subsequent quarters to more than offset the lower first quarter. Raising production, beef production for the year relative to where we were last month. Pork production raised mainly based on first quarter pace, higher pace of slaughter, which more than offsets lower weights. Broiler production up 100 million pounds based on recent slaughter and placement data. And we also expect that with lower feed costs, that's going to also give some incentive to increase production further out in the year. Turkey production adjusted a little bit lower this month. That's based on hatchery data. Prices, steer prices, just observed strong prices and strong demand for cattle, strong beef prices as well. So just, reflecting what we're seeing there in the market for both in the market for steers. Also hogs, here, hog prices, this is more based on expectations of strengthening demand, especially into the second and third quarter of this year. So pulling prices higher from where we were, a dollar per hundredweight higher from where we were last month. Turkey prices, finally a little bit of a change in direction here. Raised our turkey price forecast by a penny a pound. Those prices, as you know, have been depressed. We've been chasing them down for some point. Maybe we hit a bottom. We'll see. But a little bit of an increase there just based on observed prices. U.S. meat trade, not too many big changes here this month. Small changes just based on recent data. Pork exports up, several markets there. No one market really driving that. Broiler exports down. Again, several markets, including noticeably China and Taiwan, lower exports to there. Beef imports, again, this is something we've been increasing pretty regularly month over month. Strong demand for processing grade beef, high U.S. beef prices, and most of this is coming from Oceania, Australia in particular. So dairy. Dairy production down this month, 900 million pounds, and that reflects both a slower growth in milk per cow as well as lower cow inventory. And then tying that lower production forecast in with, tighter supplies also means tighter, tightening supplies of products as well. So higher imports and lower exports. Relatively strong U.S. prices for these products like we discussed last month. So higher imports, fat basis dairy imports, that's mainly cheese and butter on the import side, while also lower exports, U.S. exports of cheese and butter, given relatively tight supplies and strong domestic prices. Skim solids basis, many products there, many dry products, lower exports of NDM, whey, many other products as well. We're just less competitive. Global prices are coming down.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Given the fact that we are now looking at least an average Sierra Nevada snowpack for 2023-24, that comes after a year when we had more than twice the average snowpack.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
This will be the first time that California has seen two consecutive years of normal to above normal snowpack since 2015-2016 and 2016-17. So that is saying something there, almost a decade since we've seen two consecutive good years in California. And of course, that follows the three-year drought that started in 2019-20 and lasted through the 21-22 season. So again, two consecutive good years following three drought years in California. That effectively means from a hydrologic standpoint that California should be drought-free as we head through the remainder of 2024.